Water no get enemy, air no get enemy. Anne Peterman and Oren Langell, co-directors of the Global Justice Ecology Project, have written, "War, corporate globalization, environmental devastation, and human rights abuses are inextricably linked." I sat down with Anne and Oren to connect the dots between global warming, genetically engineered trees, the struggles of the Mapuche people, and the war in Iraq. The Kyoto Protocol, the agreement established to address global warming, came into effect on February 16, 2005, after Russia ratified it in October 2004. But is Kyoto enough to address climate change?
An aspect of the Kyoto Protocol that has been under criticism from activists are the loopholes. So one of the loopholes is the use of carbon trading. Can you tell us a little bit about what is carbon trading and how does that work?
Carbon trading was something that actually during the Clinton administration that Al Gore put into the Kyoto Protocol as a sort of a gimme to business in the United States. And it's considered a loophole because what it means is that corporations don't actually have to reduce their carbon emissions to be compliant with the Kyoto Protocol. What they can do instead is buy carbon emissions from another industry that has somehow reduced their emissions or has extra emissions credits for some reason. And that way they can say that they're being Kyoto compliant by buying those credits from this other company, even though they have not reduced their emissions at all. And they may have actually increased their emissions.
Do you see this, as, let's say, as a benefit, that it'll actually as a mechanism to reduce climate change problems?
No, it's a way for corporations to completely evade their responsibilities and not reduce their emissions at all. It's a serious problem, but it's one that's going to make corporations very rich because, for example, in Russia, they have many emissions credits because so much of their industry closed down during the 1990s. So they are set to make quite a lot of money, in particular the Russian mafia, to make quite a lot of money from selling these carbon credits to industries in other countries like the United States, so they don't have to decrease their emissions. So there's not really a real net benefit going on here.
Okay, one aspect that the Kyoto Protocol that people are using as a way to reduce emissions is tree plantations to store carbon. Can you explain how does this work?
Right. This is actually part of the clean development mechanism of the Kyoto Protocol. And so what this is doing is basically the World Bank and other international financial institutions are funding the development of plantations, industrial tree plantations, in countries in the global south like Brazil or Chile or South Africa, which can then sell the carbon credits that they get as a result of planting those plantations to corporations or governments that do not wish to decrease their emissions under the Kyoto Protocol. So it's yet another loophole to allow corporations to continue polluting.
In December 2003 in Milan, the United Nations agree that genetically engineered trees could be used in garbage storage plantations. And I know you've had for a couple of years now a campaign against the use of genetically engineered trees. Could you explain how does genetically engineered trees fits into Kyoto?
Sure. Well, genetically engineered trees, trees are being engineered for a variety of traits, so that the trees kill insects so that insects can't use the trees, so that they're herbicide resistant, so they can dump a lot of toxic chemicals on the trees and the trees won't die. But one of the latest things that they've come up with that industry really likes, the people who are genetically engineering the trees really likes because it's a great public relations opportunity, is this idea of genetically engineered to store more carbon, and saying that this will offset carbon emissions. So again, looking at countries in the global south for development of these genetically engineered tree plantations as so-called carbon sinks, so that they can, so that these trees will supposedly store carbon that will offset other carbon emissions, and other companies can then buy those emissions. And again, it's one of these things that just doesn't actually work on paper. Sounds real great, but actually doesn't work. Tree carbon is a very impermanent form of carbon storage, whereas the fossil fuel emissions that are going into the atmosphere are in fact permanent. So you have a temporary storage of a permanent problem, and it's just going to create more problems down the road. It's kind of deferring the problem a little bit, but really not doing anything at all.
Can you expand on the effects of having genetically engineered trees? What are their ecological effects?
Well, that's another problem, is if you look at the ecological impacts of genetically engineered trees, what you find is that they're actually going to exacerbate global warming. They're not going to help it at all. It sounds good on paper, but in reality, you know, the traits that I mentioned, this ability of trees to kill insects, the fact that these trees are being engineered for lower lignin. Lignin is the structure in a tree that makes it stand up straight and that allows trees to be used as saw timber and so on. They're trying to reduce that. So when these traits escape into native forests, which they will, there's no way to get around that, then you have these traits escaping into native forests. Now all of a sudden your native forests are having lower lignin, which means that they die easily and rot faster, which means the carbon goes into the air faster. They're killing the insects, which is disrupting the ecological integrity of that forest. They're catching fire more easily. All of these things that are huge problems. That's one of the real problems with plantations that I didn't mention, is that they catch fire. Indonesian wildfires in 1995 that were started in plantations released more carbon into the atmosphere than the entire European Union. So this is a huge problem that people are not looking at all. And genetically engineered trees will just make it much worse.
Can you talk a little bit about the campaign that you have against genetically engineered trees?
Well, right now in the United States and Canada, we have the Stop GE Trees campaign, and it's composed of about 13 different groups now. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that there's a ban, in the United States and Canada anyway, on the release of any type of genetically engineered trees, even in test plots. We're working right now with groups such as diverse as the Sierra Club in the United States, Rainforest Action Network, Polaris Institute in Canada, and like I said, about 12 more groups. And also we have an international campaign that we're working on, and maybe Ann wants to talk about that.
Sure. Well, the international campaign is partly focusing on the plantations issue that, you know, already we have this problem with industrial tree plantations that are impacting local communities, drying up water, desertifying the soil, and so on. And now they want to put in genetically engineered trees, which will just exacerbate all of those problems. In addition, we're looking at the global warming connection, which is what we've just been talking about, the use of genetically engineered trees to supposedly offset carbon emissions. So we're working with organizations and individuals all across the world trying to stop genetically engineered trees on that level.
You've recently come back from a trip from the Mapuche territories. Can you talk a little bit about that trip?
Well, the Mapuche have lived in an area that is now called Chile by the colonizers, and the Mapuche have been around for a very long time. They've kept the Incas out of the territory. They kept the Spaniards at bay for many, many hundreds of years, and they've never really ceded their territory to Chile or to any of the colonizers. And right now, their territory is under extreme threat with plantations and industrial timber plantations. And that's been they're seeing a tremendous loss of water in their communities. They're seeing many different diseases that are coming into their communities, sicknesses due to the herbicides and pesticides that are dumped onto the plantations. So we actually were in Buenos Aires for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And then from there, we went to Chile, to Mapuche territory, and talked with the Mapuche about what's going on with the plantations and also about the newest threat right now on their territory, which could be genetically engineered trees. One of the reasons why we in the Mapuche think it's going to be an immediate threat is because the state of Chile, the country of Chile, is trying to show that they are the number one tree plantation experts in the world. They're a model for tree plantations throughout the world. And if that's the case, then it's only a matter of time before genetically engineered trees are introduced. And that will be another threat upon the community of the different communities that is some Mapuche territory.
And actually, there's a conglomeration of corporations involved in Chile called Genfor, and one of them is actually a Canadian corporation called Cellfor. So there's a very direct connection between genetically engineered trees in Chile and Canada.
Okay, now let's talk about the alternatives to Kyoto. We've seen that there's certain criticisms against Kyoto, so how would you like the issue of global warming being addressed?
Well, there's a group of I'm not sure, maybe 20 organizations that have come together called the Durban Group. And we're called the Durban Group because we met in Durban, South Africa. And we met there specifically to talk about the problems with the Kyoto Protocol, in particular carbon trading and the CDM and these carbon sink plantations and so on. And what we came out of this meeting with was a call to action, basically a call to global grassroots groups, global grassroots activists, communities to come together and demand and stand up for real action on climate change, because the Kyoto Protocol is not enough. The Kyoto Protocol wants 5.2% reductions below 1990 levels by the year 2012. And what we need is 60 to 80% reductions last year. I mean, we need this stuff, and we need severe reductions, and we need them now if we're going to avert climate catastrophe. So, you know, this stuff that people are screwing around with the Kyoto Protocol, you know, it's a nice first step, but even that first step is being evaded through the clean development mechanism stuff, like the carbon sinks, the carbon trading scheme, which is projected to be worth, I forget, $60 billion, I think, by the year 2008. You know, this is a huge, huge scam is what it is. And a lot of people have criticized carbon trading as actually being the privatization of the atmosphere. You know, corporations have always been polluting, but now they have the right to pollute. They've been given the right to pollute. They've been given the right to pollute our atmosphere with global warming gases that are going to cause climate catastrophe. That's a big, big problem. And so we're calling for people all over the world to rise up. And this statement, people can sign on to the Durban Declaration by going to our website, where they can find the link to the Durban Declaration.
One of the things that people need to realize that's going on right now with the United Nations and the whole attitude toward climate change, right now we're seeing nothing but business as usual. And that's very scary because of the way that the state of the world is going right now.
What mechanisms do you think would be needed to have lower levels of carbon emissions?
Well, I think we just need to, you know, corporations just need to pollute less. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear there need to be emissions limits, you know, by 60 to 80%, you know, right away. And that's something that economists and so on say is just not realistic. But the fact of the matter is, if we don't reduce our emissions now, we are going to face climate catastrophe in a very short period of time. And it may be after, you know, these corporate CEOs and so forth, it may be after they're buried in the ground, but their children are going to be dealing with this, and their grandchildren. This is not going away.
Right. What we need to be worried about, too, is we need to be thinking of a different paradigm, a different way of doing things. That's what's at stake here. It's really life is in the balance right now, and something's going to have to be done. People are going to have to shift some of their attitudes, and hopefully with grassroots movement, we can start doing that, because people throughout the world understand this. It's just right now you have the media, you have all these things working against it. But throughout the world, I believe people's organizations are rising up, and they understand that we do need a shift in the way we approach life at this point.
Right. As long as the paradigm is about money and about profits and about stockholder profits, this isn't going to change because, you know, if we're looking at the next quarter's profits and that's how we're deciding the future of this planet, then it ain't going to go anywhere. You know, we're in big trouble. So there's got to be a whole new way of looking at how we live on and with this earth.
And if you look at the United States right now, which is one of the big purveyors of what is happening globally on a very, horrendous level with the way that you have the United States involved in a war in Iraq, which is basically about oil, and it's about oil, geopolitical control. Right now, the planet itself is what are called resources are dwindling. And because of those dwindling supplies of resources, we're going to see more and more conflicts. And because of those conflicts, I think that's one of the reasons you see the United States over in Iraq, trying to make sure that it has the oil to have control over the planet right now and over these resources that are dwindling. Oil is one of them. But then you also look toward timber, minerals. We're really in a pretty big mess, and people need to look at not only what's going on in Iraq, but just recently President Bush nominated Wolfowitz as the head of the World Bank. This should be a wake-up call to everybody on the planet to realize what the United States is about. It's about an empire. It's about building an empire. It will do it through weapons if it has to. Otherwise, now it's going to continue with economic policies that it's supported throughout the World Bank and the IMF for many years. But now it's becoming, I think, even more clear to people that this is what's going on.
You actually answered my next question, which was going to be about what are the reasons behind the U.S. occupation of Iraq. I don't know if you want to expand on that, or do you think you pretty much...
Well, just to clarify who Wolfowitz is, Paul Wolfowitz was one of the authors of the Project for a New American Century, which people can actually look up on the web and see. It's the, the George Bush ilk, if you want to call them that. In Washington, D.C., they're referred to as neocons, neoconservatives. And this is their blueprint for how they want the United States to dominate the rest of the world. And I highly recommend people to go take a look at it. It's really quite frightening how blatant they are about wanting the United States to be a global empire. And one of the keys to being a global empire is controlling oil in the Middle East, especially as the supply of oil dwindles. If they can keep a stranglehold on the biggest supplies, then they can really pretty much write their own ticket. So controlling Iraq is very critical to that. Controlling Afghanistan, because it's a way to get into the Caspian region where there's huge oil supplies. This is all together. This all works together. You know, United States military domination all over the world. And now Wolfowitz, one of the authors of this plan, is the head of the World Bank. And that is just the neatest little connection. Now we can see very clearly how the military dominance and the economic dominance and empire and ecological devastation are all tied together.
Because if you look at oil and what it's doing to the planet right now with global warming, this is just a speeded up version of what's happening, what was happening before. As the resources do dwindle, we are going to see global warming speed up. And even the Pentagon, last year, came out with a report that the London Observer, I believe, got a hold of. And even the Pentagon says we're headed toward global warming, but it could be a good thing maybe because it will do tremendous damage to Europe, and it may then put the United States in a better position to with climate. But, you know, we don't know what those projections are.
Right, but even the Pentagon is saying that we're headed toward global war, an endless global war because of global warming. So, even they understand it, but that doesn't seem to be pushing the corporations to do anything about it.
Let's now talk about the anti-war movement. You've written that the anti-war movement should make links together with, let's say, war, corporate globalization, environmental devastation, and human rights abuses. Can you expand on that point?
Well, they're just all, very much interconnected. You have economic corporate globalization, and you have the war, and it's the same coin. It's just different sides. And I think what really needs to happen is we as humans on this planet need to get together and realize this and realize who are the people that are promoting that agenda. And then we're going to have to be the people that are going to have to do something about this to try and stop this. And hopefully that as things maybe get worse, things will get better as people do come together. That's one of the biggest hopes I think we all have, that we may be a very flawed species, but I think we're starting to see that something has to be done, and hopefully we'll be able to do something about it by uniting these different factions of people that are out there, because it's really all one struggle anyway, and when we get right down to the end of it.
Right. When you look at the root causes, we're all fighting the same sources of the problems that we're facing. And so if we're all fighting the same sources, then why don't we all get together and do it together? Because certainly together we'll be stronger than when we're divided. You know, divide and conquer is one of the best strategies and most successful strategies of the other side, if you want to put it that way. So, we're ecologists, and one of the basic tenets of ecology is that everything is interconnected. In an ecosystem, the more diverse that ecosystem is, the stronger it is, the healthier it is. And so why isn't the same for our movement? Our movements are all interconnected, and the more diverse our movement is, the stronger it will be, the more resilient it will be, the more able to stand up and be successful it will be.
Now, what actions do you think, what strategies are necessary for an anti-war movement to stop the war in Iraq?
Well, the anti-war movement, in my opinion, as we were just talking about, needs to have a broader view that this war is not just about Iraq. There was somebody who made an analogy. They said, well, you know, what if it's like their house is burning? You know, we have to take care of the house that's burning first before we do anything else. My response to that is, well, except that you have somebody with a flamethrower going and lighting various houses in a row on fire, and it seems to me you need to take care of the person with the fire thrower, and then you take care of each of the houses that's on fire. Otherwise, you know, you're not stopping the problem, and the problem is they're in Iraq now, but they're going to be going to Iran next or Syria next. They're not finished. Plus, you have to look at the fact that while this conflagration's going on in Iraq, they are causing unbelievable devastation all over the world with their economic policies. Millions and millions of people are dying as a result of these economic policies all over the world. And so if we're talking about an anti-war movement, we have to look at the economic war as well as the violent war. Otherwise, there's just no point.
Yeah, there's an estimate right now that there's 20 to 30,000 people a day that are dying across the earth because of economic policies. And then people wonder, you know, in the United States, why does a lot of the world hate the United States? Well, that's one of the reasons, I think, because that there's an unbelievable amount of suffering going on with the way that the United States is flaunting itself. I think in right now the anti-war movement in the United States is going to have to get serious, as Ann said, and it's not just about Iraq, it's about the empire. But the movement, I believe, is going to have to work a lot more closely with people that are in the military right now, with the soldiers. It's going to be very important to right. We're seeing signs that recruiters on campuses are being chased off right now. I think that's a very positive sign. We need to people in the United States, I believe, need to make it impossible for the war machine to continue. And that's going to be, you know, people are going to have to disobey their government to make things work, to work for our side, to stop a war, to stop this injustice. It's a totally illegal war. Then people are dying, not just, you know, United States civilians, but people are dying, you know, Iraqis, Afghans, in a military conflict that is based on making a few corporations richer and also to set up continue the dominance of the United States worldwide. And I think that people will wake up to this in the United States eventually, even though one of the great things about the empire is it's kept a pretty good handle on the media, and corporate media has done a great disservice to the people of the United States. And as Bush is flaunting all this talk about democracy, in the United States there's no democracy, and there's not even, you know, we don't even have a populace that has all the facts to make the decisions. And
which is why stations like this are so important. We appreciate the opportunity to come on and rant and rave like this.
Do you have any final comments, something that wasn't addressed or something you would like to expand upon?
No, I think this has been great. You know, we appreciate the opportunity to connect all the dots, and people may not, it may not be evident what the connection is between genetically engineered trees and the war in Iraq, but, you know, oil is really the link between them both. The war in Iraq is about oil, and these genetically engineered trees being promoted for carbon sinks is about being able to continue to burn fossil fuels. So really, all of these issues are connected, and that's one of the things that is our mission in our organization, is drawing out those connections so that we can understand how we as activists all can work together toward the same root causes.
For those who want to learn more, how can people get in touch with you?
We can be reached on our website at www.globaljusticeecology.org.
Oh, yeah. And just before we end, I know you have a documentary which will be coming out very soon. Do you want to give the particulars about that?
Yeah, one of the things that we're doing about the genetically engineered trees issue is we have a video that we've put together with some folks out in Santa Cruz, Rain Dancer Films and Earthlinks and Three Americas. And it's narrated by Dr. David Suzuki, which most people in Canada probably are familiar with. And it's a great video. He is very passionate about the issue of genetically engineered trees. And so if you are interested in that, get a hold of us through our website. It will be released hopefully sometime in the next couple of weeks. And we would love to have people set up showings in their community, and we'll be distributing it with action toolkits and other information about genetically engineered trees. And it's a really great video, so we hope people will check it out.
And the name of the video is?
Is A Silent Forest, The Growing Threat of Genetically Engineered Trees. It's about 45 minutes.
It's been a pleasure talking to you both.
Well, we thank you, and it was great being here.